Good morning and welcome to Claudio's Speakeasy and Radio Theater. And now your host, raconteur, master narrator, master chef, master seafarer, and if you ever got a job on a fishing boat, master, well, we won't go there. Here he is, star of stage, screen, and now gracing the airwaves here at WCOM, Claudio.
Still baiting that hook. Yeah. Thanks for that intro. This is Claudio Speakeasy in Radio Theater. Thank you for tuning us in. We've got a splendid show coming up this morning, a show that I'm actually looking forward to listening to more than talking. It's going to be Jim Carl. Let me get my volume up here. Jim Carl, who's senior director of the historic Carolina Theater of Durham, which is also the sponsor of Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater, so big shout out. All sorts of things going on there. You'll get cued into all things cinema in a moment. Got Jim Carl in the studio. Of course, that was Bill McClymont doing the intro. And we've actually got historian Bob Crowley sitting by silent so that he can learn how to run the board for a Christmas show we're doing together next week. He's dug up Christmas archives that go all the way back to the late 1800s. And it's going to be more of a satirical Christmas. I'm really looking forward to that show. But today's show is going to be with Jim Carl of the Carolina Theater. Before we go any further in that direction, I want to give quick acknowledgement to my underwriter, the Apex Arts Council, of which Bob Crowley is president, and, of course, the historic Carolina Theater of Durham. And before going any further, I'd like to pay my tribute to Nelson Madiba Mandela, since I grew up in South Africa. From prisoner to president, what an extraordinary journey you made of your long walk home, to visit with us all. While your very soul exceeded all restraints, where your body was confined alone. There was the twinkling gleam of mischief, of the joy of the inner child, omnipresent in your loving eyes. And your spirit is proof that a child shall lead them. As your generosity of soul and discipleship of forgiveness can emanate from no other source so genuine or enduring as your lingering light that now shines upon futures we have yet to prove, Madiba. And they finally laid him to rest. I just wanted to give that acknowledgement. Seems like a nice way to sum it up. And now, let's go to the movies. Good morning, Jim Carl.
Oh, very good morning to you, Claudio.
Good to have you on. You were here in the early days when I was still stumbling through it all, stumbling a little less
yes,
these days.
Yes, I think we were both stumbling back in those days, Claudia.
And you have really made the film scene happen
well,
at the Carolina
you.
Theater.
I have never seen
it this active.
Yeah, we've been very, very busy at the theater. It just seems to have exploded over the last few years with so many different film series, film festivals, retrospectives, on and on and on.
You've caught on, man.
I would like to hope so. It was still a way to go. Still a way to go.
Absolutely.
Yes.
No, I just think that... From what I'm seeing when I work live shows, I'm seeing the cinema's basically being swamped. So you're obviously selling more tickets now than we ever did.
We definitely are. We're also getting a lot of more clout within the international and as well as the national filmed industry. We're getting a lot of archival prints that a lot of other studios would not even allow out of the vault in order to be shown at the theater. A lot of master prints, answer prints, things like that.
Where did you get that clout?
It's just taken years and years of getting in with the different distributors and getting to know them on a one-to-one basis. It always starts with one. Mm-hmm. One gives you the opportunity to take an answer print. An answer print, if for those listeners out there who are not aware what that is basically one of the last surviving 35mm prints in existence of a particular film. And so if something were to happen to that film, if it were to get scratched or get lost in the mail, something were to happen, the likelihood of a studio striking a new 35mm print at about a $15,000 cost is very almost impossible that it's going to happen. So
and of
the
course
studios,
it has to be preserved in a very
particular
way.
It has to be preserved, yes. So the studios are very particular to whom they allow those answer prints, who can rent them, who's allowed to screen them, and we're on that short list. And that's taken years and years to get the studios, again, one at a time. Started with Universal Studios, first allowed us to have answer prints, and allows us to show films that you would not normally get to see anywhere else on the big screen in their original format. Now, that's great news. Of course, the other big news is that last month in November, we did convert to the new DCP 2K projector. So we can now show films, beautiful films in DCP, restored films, a lot of the classics back on the big screen. And sometimes when you call a studio and ask them for a particular title, they'll say, well, we have no 35 millimeter prints of that film in existence anymore. And we're not even talking, Claudio, about films from the 30s and 40s like people think. We're talking about films as late as the mid-90s.
What?
Yeah. As an example, I've been trying to book just a film, I'm not sure if you're even familiar with it, The Rocketeer by Disney Films, which came out in 1991. Walt Disney has no 35 millimeter prints. As a matter of fact, just until last year, Universal had no prints of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho.
What?
Yeah.
This is unbelievable.
Yeah. So what happens is that, you know, the film stock from the, you know, from the early film, from the early days of filmmaking, and the film gets brittle. It starts to fade, lose its color, turn vinegary, and the studios decide to toss the prints. Now, that's one way that a print can get destroyed. Another way that a print can get destroyed is that just have a, you know, a projectionist who threads the film wrong, and the sprockets tear through the celluloid, and you have big green scratches going down the side of the film. Or in some cases, I'm sure that there has been more than one or two sticky fingers where a film has fallen off the back of a particular courier's truck. So the studios are very, very particular as to who gets to hold on to, gets to screen their answer prints. So yeah, so that's something we're really proud of, to have the Carolina Theater be on that short list of theaters that the studios recognize are going to handle their prints with dignity, are going to treat them well, and are going to ship them back on time.
Well, how does all this play into the whole new setup now?
Well, with the new setup, for example, when I could call a studio and ask for, let's say, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, I would call Fox, 20th Century Fox, and say, do you have a print? And they would say, no, we no longer have any 35 millimeter prints. Well, that would really limit me. I can no longer show the film. Neither can anyone else. But what's been happening with the new DCP, it's DCP stands for Digital Cinema Print.
Okay.
And what that means is that some very smart wizard out there in the community that I don't know that much about actually somehow digitizes the master negative. So let's go back to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. So somewhere at 20th Century Fox, some very smart person is actually taking the master negative of that film and digitizing it into a huge server on the computer.
Is this as tricky as I'm imagining it, a detail-oriented?
I can only imagine, Claudio. I'm not an IT person. But and while they're doing this, they're doing all of the color correction, the restoration. They're restoring the film.
Frame for frame.
Frame for frame, back to its original condition as it would have been in 1968 when the film originally premiered.
So Technicolor, so to speak.
It's a beautiful print. I mean, it'll only ever look as good as the original source materials, if that makes sense.
Right.
So if you have a bad copy of a master negative with scratches, you're going to end up, there's no way to really fix that.
We'll romanticize the scratches, but they'll still be there.
Yeah.
Right?
So anyway, what we'll do is we'll actually digitize this film and put it into the server. So now we flash forward all these years later, and I call up 20th Century Fox and ask for a print of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid on DCP. And what they'll tell me is they do have it. And it's actually quite ingenious. What they do is take a computer hard drive, hook it up to the server, and actually burn a copy of the film for you on a hard drive that will only play in the projector with the serial number at your theater.
Oh, my God.
So that even though I have this hard drive and they ship it to you and you install it and upload it, and it's called ingesting it into the hard drive there at the theater, there's a key code attached to that particular hard drive. The key code arrives separately via email. I receive the key code. I punch a couple of numbers into the keypad there on the server, and it unlocks the film. And it only unlocks it for a couple of hours, just long enough so that you can play it, at which point the key code expires, the film locks up again so that you can't have any unauthorized screenings, and then
and
you ship the hard drive back.
And does it have a stop factor in when you've run the amount of shows you're supposed to run, it doesn't run anymore? Or?
Exactly. What happens is the key code, it'll only be good for however long I book the film. So let's say I book Butch Cassidy on the Sundance Kid, to use that as a continuing reference, and I say to the studio, I'm planning to show it on Friday, December the 20th, for example. I book it. So the key code arrives, and it's only valid from maybe, let's say, 10 in the morning on Friday, December 20th until 9 p.m. that evening. And so it'll after 9 p.m. that night, that key code expires. The film locks back up on the server, and I can no longer run it. Neither can anyone else. And
then I was wondering how they're going to get around
it's
that.
It's actually become very interesting. It's a part of the business industry that I was not very familiar with up until about 3 or 4 months ago when we started talking about converting to the DCP there at the theater. Mm-hmm. So I've had to learn. It's been a steep learning curve. But on the bright side, we may not, like I said, we're not going to have as much 35-millimeter films as we have in the past. But on the bright side, we now have access to quite a few films that we otherwise would have never been able to screen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very exciting, yes.
And do you think there must be a whole new industry in creating masters of... digital masters?
I'm not entirely sure, Claudio. I would say there probably is. I mean, that type of technology, I mean... On the one hand, you're phasing out all of these projectionists that have grown up through the years on 35-millimeter that are suddenly becoming irrelevant.
Cinema Paradiso,
whatever. Mm-hmm. They're becoming irrelevant. They're being now suddenly we have these new DCP projectors, DCP projectors, and but on the other hand, you also now have a new industry opening up. I can only imagine that the projectionists that we have that are on 35 that are being phased out are also being replaced on some other side by IT guys and computer technicians that know how to digitize these films. So as one job industry is being phased out, another one is giving birth.
Now, to say that there's not going to be a projectionist, doesn't somebody still need to be running this?
No. Not the way it's created now.
Oh, wow.
Eventually, the DCP projectors, apart from literally walking into the room and turning on the lights and powering the booth up, the way the projectors are, once you've ingested the film into the projector, tested it, then you can actually schedule it. Just like you would a computer, an alarm clock, you program it so that it starts, the thing starts itself up, it plays the trailers, it opens the masking, brings up the house lights,
Amazing.
Turn off the house lights, corrects itself to the proper sound format, whether it's 5.1, DTS, or surround, does all the work for you, and you can program it for weeks in advance.
Mankind is fast becoming the second fiddle.
So, yeah, I mean... because we do so much else at the Carolina Theater, other than just mainstream films like 12 Years a Slave or American Hustle, we have so many retrospectives and film festivals. We will never,
which is your baby, really,
right? Yeah, we will never be at that point where we are a projectionless facility.
Right. Okay.
We will always have a projectionist because we need those projectionists for so many of our classic film series where we are trying to show films still on 35-millimeter.
Until even they are mastered in mm-hmm. the new medium, yeah.
And the other thing to remember is that studios, of course, are big business.
Right.
They, as thousands of titles in each studio's catalog and their library that they own the rights to, as most big business, the films that are at the top of the list that they're going to digitize and that are going to convert to DCP are going to be the more recent films, the more new releases, the bigger titles.
Right, I can see that. So they're not going to focus as much on the past.
Exactly. So sometimes when you call the studio up and you're looking for a title from the 30s, 40s, even 60s, 70s, and 80s, you're not guaranteed that they're always going to have converted it. They may eventually get to it. Think of it the way that when DVDs or Blu-rays first came out. You know, not everything you always wanted to see was automatically available on DVD or Blu-ray.
Unless you're talking about Lawrence of Arabia or Dr. Zhivago or things that really stood out.
Exactly. Yeah. The big hits, the big titles. Of course, they're going to remaster those and release those on DCP as fast as possible. But when you start talking about the lesser films, the films that were not nominated for 12 Academy Awards or things like that.
Or the bad movie genre.
Yeah. I mean, it has taken it will take many, many years before some of the films that...
No doubt.
That are before the entire catalog is completely digitized. I'll call the studio up and ask for a particular title, and I'll let them know that we have capacity at the theater for showing films on 35 millimeter, on DCP, and other formats. And
now,
that allows us.
I thought I'd seen everything replaced as far as projection systems go.
No, we still have we have 35 millimeter capability in two of our halls.
I got you.
We are a two-screen theater, and we have the opportunity to screen on a third venue in Fletcher Hall from time to time.
Right, whenever there's a live show.
Exactly. Yeah. And so what happens is during film festivals and retrospectives, I'll book the Fletcher Hall auditorium, but I am limited in that hall as to what format I can show films in. So basically in the Fletcher Hall auditorium, it's going to be 35 millimeter.
I got you. Okay, mm-hmm. Got you. Well, let's take a little musical break just so we can catch our breath. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Jim about something he does on the side. He works with a tattoo artist, his brother. We'll go into that a bit and then right back to film. You're listening to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater here on WCOM 103.5 FM. I'm here in the studio with Jim Carr, the senior director of the Carolina Theater, and also our president, Bill McClymont of WCOM. Let's go to some music.
Thank you.
And just when you thought it was safe to get back in the water, fins everywhere. I don't think we have your mic on just yet. There we go. He's here. He's back. Hey, before we go back to more
sure.
cinema treats, this is great stuff. I'm getting a whole new education here. That's why you're going to be doing all the talking.
All right. We'll see what I can do.
But I like the idea that you've got a little getaway from what you do at the mm-hmm. theater every day by working with your brother in a tattoo shop. Give us the rundown there.
Yeah, well, my brother has been tattooing for more than 20 years, and he's a professional tattoo artist. So
Black Lotus Tattoo, Black, I believe.
Mm-hmm, in Raleigh, on Hillsborough Street. And one of the things that he got me to do is start going with them to these tattoo conventions across the country. I mean, I'm not an artist as far as I cannot draw in my life.
But he
inherited all of that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I can program anything you want, it's just kind of a funny thing because he's the artist in the family. He can draw anything he wants, and I inherited all the skills of organization. So I'm very organized when it comes to putting together a film festival, or in his case, you know, putting everything together that he needs for a convention. So I started traveling with him to conventions around the country, you know, organizing the entire trip, getting there, filling out all the paperwork, all the stuff that I would normally do for filmmakers. And I'm dealing with, you know, sensitive artists all the time in the filmmaking side. So dealing with a persnickety artist, you know, who happens to be my own, you know, blood is not too much different.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I started going out on the road with him, going to different conventions. And
now, what's the thing you enjoy most about it? Is it the visual art or the people?
I like the people.
Okay,
I like the people. I mean, I deal so much these days with because for the Carolina Theater, what I do is purely the cinema side. I don't get involved with any of the live events anymore. I did years ago. But for those that have worked in the film business, in the film industry, you'll know that actors and directors and producers are their own quirky breed that you have you have to really be able to get focused and to be able to work with that, especially for years and years and years. So it is nice to be able to take a break and instead work with veterans and work with all mm-hmm. the different people that come into a tattoo shop looking for tattoos that are not industry related, film industry related, and
I was surprised
get to meet different people.
I was surprised you told me that a lot of the traffic is actually more high end than you would think.
It is. It very much is. I mean, I haven't always worked with my brother, but I've been very, very surprised at the clientele that he brings in. It is very upscale.
I know you said there's a lot of military, which I can mm-hmm. see. I would have assumed there'd be a lot of college kids nature.
There is that demographic as mm-hmm. well, but it's not necessarily the clientele that he specifically caters to, let's say.
But you're particularly impressed with the fact that what would you say the clientele actually is?
As far as age range, mm-hmm. probably in their 30s to 40s.
Okay, and middle to upper class?
I would say so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're going to get, you know, just like you would at any film festival, a good cross-representation of all demographics.
Right.
But primarily, I mean, it would be somebody in their 30s or 40s that's middle class that comes in for a tattoo, sometimes looking for their first tattoo. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I do enjoy meeting the people. I do enjoy having a change from working with just studios, filmmakers, distributors, artists, things like that.
And that's actually a pretty abstract change.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even with the Carolina Theater, basically what I do with all the film festivals is program the films, select the titles, deal with the studios, the distributors, the producers, the filmmakers, things like that. It's only every now and then that I really get a chance to interact with the audience.
Mm, I got you.
And so I'm on the phone so much. I'm trying to stay behind the scenes as much as possible. And so I except for the retro film series that we produce, where I get to actually meet the audience, the general film goer that comes to the Carolina Theater, I really don't get the chance to meet them and get mm-hmm. to know them that much, which is a shame. But working at the shop with my brother with the tattoos,
It's more hands-on.
And what I really like about it is that I can be there and completely shut the film side off
mm-hmm.
and not sit there thinking about terms and negotiations and having to think about what movies are coming up and things like that. I can actually just focus on the job at hand and look at the art that's being produced.
I'm going to come by and drop in on you guys. Well, I'm glad to know you've got that kind of refuge.
Thank you.
Just to be so completely disconnected. And now back to where you live.
Okay. Back to the film is at the Carolina Theater.
What got you, I know years ago you sort of touched on this whole, the Retro Film Festival and some of these other things that you put together. What was it that initially gave you the bug to go in that direction?
That gave me the direction to program at the Carolina Theater or to get in the business in the first place?
Well, I would say answer both. You gave me an additional question there. But in particular, towards some of the programming that you've gone to, but let's have the history on what got you into the Carolina Theater.
Got me into the Carolina Theater, I had been living in New York City, going to film school, working on different TV shows and movies. I knew early on when I was growing up, military family, so we moved around quite a bit all over the United States, but I knew early on that I wanted to get into the film business, and so as soon as I was able to afford to move to New York City, I was 20 years old, on my own.
That's a tough age to afford New York City.
I didn't know that at the time. You know, nowadays I wouldn't even dare try it, but when you're 20 years old, I knew everything. So I moved to New York City, 20 years old, never been there before in my life, went to film school. Second day of film school, I heard about an internship happening. There was a TV show back in the 80s called The Equalizer.
Mm-hmm. I remember. I like it.
Yeah, with Edward Woodward.
Yeah.
And the show was ending, and they needed an intern to go in there. And there was students from all over the city applying for this internship. I'm fresh off the boat 2 days in film school. I hear about it and decide to go in. And I basically get chewed out for not having a resume and things like that. So anyway, long story short, of course, I was the one that got the internship.
That's wild.
It's 2 days in living in New York City, within 3 months, I was working for Universal. The studio, the same producer that was producing The Equalizer was Dick Wolf, and just started a new show called Law & Order.
God, he's all immediately, over the place now.
Yeah, it was just whirlwind. Got sucked into Law & Order, started working there for 2 seasons.
You must have just hit a right note with somebody.
I sure did, It was just pure luck, But after a couple of seasons working in television and working, you know, on different films through shooting throughout the city, I kind of just got burned out on the film industry and decided I needed a break from it. So I kind of had to reassess what I wanted to do with my life at that point. And I realized that what I needed to do was basically go back and finish my undergraduate's degree at that point. So I took a break, moved to West Virginia for 2 years, and decided to live in the mountains as a hermit with a lot of other college students and be a college student
again. That movie Deliverance, and decided to go there.
So this is now in my mid-20s, so I'm thinking to myself what I really want to do with my life right now is just take a break from living in the big city and go live in the mountains.
I can totally appreciate that.
And just be secluded and be a kid again, you know, be a college student. I was in my early 20s, 21, 22, 23, and working on TV sets and big motion pictures and doing all the traveling. And suddenly I just wanted to go back and be in college again. So
I was jumping around as a chef at sea during that period. So we both had a sense of adventure.
So West Virginia for 2 years. And then after West Virginia, I decided that I had never lived in North Carolina. Let's try the Tar Heel State. So I moved down to North Carolina. I'd never been here before other than driven through it on my way somewhere
else.
Random
shot.
Yeah.
Any particular location?
I was originally looking at the Raleigh-Durham Triangle area. Yeah. Again, never having been here, I had heard great things about it. So I moved down here, and again, just like I did when I moved to New York City several years earlier, I was here, I was looking at getting my master's degree, and I heard about this little theater in Durham, North Carolina that had just reopened, was looking for some hired help. It's called the Carolina Theater. Mm-hmm. This is probably early 1995. The theater had been open a couple of months at that point.
I started in 93 helping to reopen it,
Helping to reopen it, yeah. But I think the real reopening happened in, what is it, Claudio, February 1994?
Something to point to, I believe it was,
It was 1994, because I know the theater had only had been open less than a year.
Yeah, I'm talking bricks and mortar when
you're,
I first
you're
joined.
Talking, yeah, actually getting it suitable
getting it
to even have
building
people
building the stage, building the flyer, et cetera,
So, so I applied for the job and got hired based on my experience with film school and things like that. And I didn't really at the time think to myself, gee, this is a place where I'm going to see myself in 20 years. I took the job basically just to have something, an income at the time.
The practical side of things.
It was. And remember that in those days, the theater did not necessarily have a branding or an identity at that point.
Right.
As it does today.
No, it doesn't.
The theater had just reopened and was still trying to create that brand.
It was more known for cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is it going to be? It's going to be, you know, this new theater, this restored theater.
Yeah.
None of the festivals existed. None of the...
It had its day back in the 20s when it was a vaudeville house, basically.
Yeah.
The stage was used, but it had been dormant for so many years.
Yeah, it had been dormant. It was held together for many years by volunteers and things like that. But in 94, when it reopened its doors, there was this conscious decision made by the board and by the city that the Carolina Theater was going to have this new image, but nobody really knew what that image was going to be
once it rose above the image of the parking lot.
Yes, once it goes beyond the image of just being a restored theater. I mean, suddenly we have this beautifully restored theater, but what are we going to put in it? So anyway, I mean, making a long story shorter, I started working on trying to figure out what demographics in the Triangle are already being served. I mean, at the time, you had several art house theaters in the area that were already operating. So,
and let me just interrupt for a second. The reason I bring this up and the reason I asked you the question, what gave you the bug to go retro and all the things that you've added to it, because originally it was just plain cinema. Mm-hmm. You brought in... a bit of a video library that was more international, which was immediately popular, but that phased out. And then you started going more in unpredictable directions with film itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I was getting at was that, again, we had to create this branding of what is the festival. I mean, what is the Carolina Theater? And I was taking a look around the Triangle, trying to figure out what's already happening, what communities are already being served and what are being underserved. And so from that started the genesis of the North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. Once that was founded, then we moved on to, I wanted to start it. I noticed that we had a lot of horror fans, a lot of genre fans, you know, mystery, Bram Stoker Society kind of things happening in the Triangle.
Okay.
I was very interested in that. I've always had a love for genre films, whether they're horror, sci-fi, mystery, thrillers, things like that. So at that point, I thought to myself, what we really should be doing is trying to bring some of these classic movies back to the big screen, not just the independent art house theaters that, you know, or art house movies that are already showing at a lot of other theaters in the Triangle, but bring back some of these classic films that are, to be honest, don't have the reputation of things like an Orson Welles or Casablanca,
right,
or Alfred. I mean, all the art house theaters back in the 80s, that seemed to be the thing. Whenever I thought art house theater when I was growing up in the 80s and early 90s, I would look at things, you know, playing in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Omaha, at those art house theaters, and everybody was pretty much programming the same things. They were programming, you know, everybody does Hitchcock, Truffaut. There's, you know, for lack of a better word, there's a cycle there of directors that seem to be getting all the attention. And I was more interested in the films that were not getting the attention, you know, the horror films from the early 80s and the late 70s, and not just the big classics like The Exorcist, but the smaller films with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know, the Terror Trains and Prom Nights and that stuff of the, you know. And so I knew that there was an audience that existed in the Triangle, or at least I hoped there was.
Yeah.
And we started putting together this series called Retro Phantasma, which was basically bring backs to the screen of some of the lesser... What's the word I want to say here? Not necessarily the films that were the critics' favorites. I wasn't necessarily going to win any awards.
You wouldn't refer to them as B-movies, would you?
No, not necessarily. They're not. A B-movie, in my mind, is a film that starts off being bad to begin with.
Yeah.
I'm talking about films that... we're not going to be Academy Award contenders, let's say, but that were, and not, maybe not critical successes, but financial successes. But bringing fun films back to the screen. I guess that was the key word, fun films, which everyone else seemed to be focusing on critical masterpieces. I wanted to bring fun back into the Carolina Theater. I wanted there to be a sense of entertainment, a good time, not just necessarily an educational time, which is important as well. But that's the reason that I started the Retro Phantasma film series, along with a couple of other volunteers.
And it's actually a venue that is to quite a quite a number of people in Durham, especially, a recreational place to go. So yeah, you've got to offer more than one thing.
And what's interesting is that once we started the Retro Phantasma film series, which we were bringing back things like Evil Dead 2 and the Friday the 13th, so the Nightmare on Elm Street, we started building a community. A community of fans who enjoy that kind of film, who appreciate that, and who don't necessarily have a reverence for those kind of products upon the screen that are not, we're not talking about the Rocky Horror Picture Show type of mentality either, where, you know, people are talking back to the screen and making a lot of noise, which is something I cannot stand. Yeah. I'm talking about having a real respect for the material, which is the kind of audience that we wanted to bring into the theater. And as the years went on, you know, a lot of new fans starting appearing, and I think at first there was this mentality that they believed, especially the newbies, that they were going to walk into a Mystery Science Theater 3000 or Rocky Horror Picture Show type of experience, and when they actually would arrive and see that, no, this is nothing like that. This is a complete reverse. This is a community of film aficionados that appreciate, for lack of a better word, great trash.
And you also did successfully create. I can appreciate that. I mean, can we pick me up a little? I'm not hearing myself in my headset at all, and I don't know if it's got to do with there or here.
Well, it was the
testing great 1 2 1 2. Okay,
it was the great Pauline Kael from the New Yorker, that her famous quote was, "Movies are rarely such great art that unless one learns to appreciate great trash, there's very little reason in going."
That's true. No, my point was that you guys pretty much early on started creating a bit of cross pollination, because cinema was getting a lot more attention than the live stage, and then gradually we got a lot of those folks from cinema to go and take a chance of watching a performance.
Yes. Yeah, there has been a cross-pollination, and it's taken a long time. It's taken a long time not only to grow the audiences, but to have the audience trust the brand.
Right.
The brand is the Carolina Theater. I mean, since those early days in the 90s when we started with the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival and Retro Phantasma, we've added the Nevermore Horror Film Series. I'm sorry, the Nevermore Horror Film Festival, which is a juried competition festival, all new, brand new releases, the Escapism Film Festival, which has over the years morphed into more of a classic bringbacks of family films, everything from, well, I consider to be family films, things like It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, Superman, the movie, The Goonies, things like that. It's become very popular. This year we partnered with the Comic-Con, the North Carolina Comic-Con, who handles the Comic-Con event next door at the Civic Center, and we partnered and produced the Comic Quest Film Festival, which was basically focusing on classic comic book inspired movies. Right. So we show things like 1966's Batman the movie with, you know, what is his name? Adam West,
my
Burt
God,
Ward.
Yeah. Way back.
Yeah, Danger Diabolique with John Philip Law. You know, again, just fun films. Mm-hmm. It wasn't anything dark. It wasn't, I don't even necessarily want to go there, but we tried to keep the tone light. We tried to keep all of our programming light. I mean, we do have a lot of serious films that play at the Carolina Theater during, you know, Oscar season and things like that. But I really wanted to focus on family. I wanted to focus on entertainment. I wanted the theater, especially the film programs that we produce, to be a place where people can bring their families. And what I started discovering over the years is that there is a huge, huge amount of people who are, they're seeking nostalgia. I don't necessarily know what has happened in the last 15 years, necessarily, maybe on a national level, but for a certain age group, to those born of a certain age, especially in the 70s and 80s, there seems to be a real effort being made in the last few years to re-experience things that they grew up with. Maybe it's cyclical. I remember when I was growing up in the 80s, the 60s were very popular. Right. Everybody wanted to talk about the 60s when it was the 1980s. And now here we are in 2013, and everything seems to be about the 1980s all of a sudden. But there does seem to be a real effort being made by Generation X and Generation Y to relive the movies that they first experienced as children, you know, back on the big screen.
Something somebody really brought to my attention quite recently is that people are getting tired of everything these days that's being cranked out being so full of special effects that you have no storyline. And I'm wondering if that isn't lending itself somewhat.
Perhaps. I talk to a lot of our fans who come to the Retro series, and what I'm hearing from them is this fascination to bring their families to see something on the big screen that they grew up seeing themselves, whether it's a Disney film like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, even something from the, you know, from the late 80s like Rain Man or Driving Miss Daisy or The Color Purple.
Right.
They're very interested in bringing their families to experience these things that they experienced when they were children, bringing their kids. I have a lot of families, especially a lot of parents that come to these programs and bring their kids, who say that, you know, their children, because of Netflix and iPads and iTunes and things like that, really don't spend too much time unless they're not exposed, for example, to a lot of the older classics.
That I can imagine.
They're not exposed to the other classics. The schools are really not teaching them as much anymore, especially when it comes to film. But having these series at the Carolina Theater allows parents to bring their children with them. And, I mean, just 2 weeks ago, we ran Gojira, which is the 1954 uncut version in Japanese of 1954's Godzilla.
Ah, okay.
And we practically sold out the screening. I mean, it was just families bringing their children. I mean, and I really thought there would be some pushback because the film is subtitled. But no, we had a lot of families just bringing their kids. Like I said, there's a real fascination right now with nostalgia, especially anything 70s and 80s. And like I said, going back to the branding of the Carolina Theater, when we started doing the film programming in the mid-90s, you know, we were only 10 years removed at that time from the 1980s. Mm-hmm. So we were showing a lot of things from the 1970s. And now that we're in 2013, you know, we're showing things from the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. I have what's called a 20-year rule, where I believe in my programming, especially when it comes to bringing classics back to the big screen, that at least 20 years need to have passed for a generation to grow up, to be nostalgic about wanting to go see that film back on the big screen. And I've tested myself on this theory several times by programming films from the late 90s. And there's always one or two exceptions to that particular rule. But for the most part, 20 years really needs to pass for someone to really want to go back and re-experience that film on the big screen and bring their families with them. And that's really where we've capitalized. And that's where our niche has been in the specialty programming of our cinemas when we're bringing back all these retrospectives, Studio Ghibli, Akira Kurosawa, the retro film series, even during Nevermore and Escapism, our other film festivals, we still try to bring back as many classics as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And what's been nice about that is that even though we now have this reputation for almost becoming a revival house, revival house is a term that I don't really hear that much anymore.
No, it's true.
It was very popular back in the 70s and 80s when they talked about art houses being revival houses. But it's been nice hearing the distributors, the studios, and fans look at the Carolina Theater and call us a revival house. I guess maybe 20 years ago I might have been a little insulted by that. But not anymore. Now I actually take great pride in the fact that we are known not only for being a first-run art house theater, but also being a revival house, because there's so few of them left.
And this whole study that you've just revealed to us on what makes people go and what makes them respond to these different films, has this been a direct study between you and your audience? Because I know that you get a lot of responses from them, and you actually make it a point to meet audiences so that you can educate yourself in that regard.
I do.
Is this where that comes from?
It is. At our retro film series, for example, we many, many years ago started doing, you know, just little door prizes here and there. And one of the reasons I did the door prizes originally was to collect information on the people that were coming to those series. I no longer do that. Now I've simplified it so that to qualify for a door prize, all you basically have to do is just put your name on a little slip of paper and drop it into a collection basket. But one of the one question I did leave on that little piece of paper is, what is the number one film that you'd like to see us bring to the Carolina Theater?
Gotcha, directly to the source.
And I used to specify, you know, what's the number one film from the 70s, 80s, or 90s? What's the number one horror film? What's the number one? But nowadays I've opened it up and it's just, what is the number one film from the 30s through the 90s that you'd like to get? And every week we collect these little slips of paper, and every week I go through every one of those slips and take notes of what people want me to bring back for these series. And then twice a year we do what I call the Facebook poll, where I will literally put lists and lists and lists of films that people have asked on these surveys throughout the year that I've collected, and I create a poll on Facebook for our fans to then sit there and let me know, here are the films that people are requesting. Now, mind you, I've already done a lot of research on these films as far as the rights and the availability, because there's no point in somebody writing down Star Wars or Snow White and the Seven Dwarves on a slip of on a survey slip when you know there's no chance that the studios are ever going to let you screen them. Now you're suddenly throwing those out on a Facebook poll, and there's no chance of you ever showing them, so why even put them on the poll in the first place? So I do all the research up front and figure out what's available, where the rights are, whether prints exist or if it's going to be a DCP, and then I put them up on Facebook and let the audience and the fans vote on their the ones they really want. And it's created an interaction between us and the fans that I had never experienced.
Well, give us that point of interaction so that the audiences here can take note, website or any way of connecting with you in this regard, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, I mean, anyone is welcome to join our Facebook page, whether it's the Carolina Theater Facebook page or the Nevermore Film Festival and Retro Phantasma Film Festival Facebook pages. Like I said, twice a year we put the polls out where the fans can choose the films that they want to see. When I program the retro film series, for example, I program in six-month blocks. And so even though the audience can't see what we're looking at right now, Claudio, I actually brought a copy of the program. For example, what I'm holding in my hand that you might want to pick up at the theater someday is what I call the retro brochure. It's 6 months at a time. I program 6 months out. This particular issue is the January through June 2014 issue, which means that it covers all of the different series that are playing at the Carolina Theater in the retro program between January and June 2014. And if you're flipping through the pages, you'll notice that the retro program is divided into three different iterations. There's Retro Classics, Retro Phantasma, and Retro Treasures. So the three different series, the original, of course, is Retro Phantasma, which focuses on genre films, genre meaning horror, sci-fi, thriller, things like that, from the mid-70s up to about the mid-90s, again, that 20-year rule. So I'm allowing films up to about 1994 into the series. Retro Classics is from the same thing, genre films from the mid-70s, think Spielberg's Jaws in 1975, going all the way back to the silent era. We've shown Silence. And then Retro Treasures is the newest iteration, and that again, it's coming from the surveys when people were requesting comedies and dramas that didn't fit into the other two series. So we said to ourselves, well, why not include comedies and dramas? And it's been very successful. So this Retro Treasure series is our newest retro program. Each of these programs is once a month. So that's Retro Classics is once a month, Treasures is once a month, Phantasma is once a month. So that's actually a retro series three times a month.
Let me read some of the titles that are coming up. I'm not going to give dates or anything, just to give you an idea here. We've got the Wicker Man Final Cut, The Third Man, Dracula, Freaks, Jim Henson's The Muppet Movie, Harvey, Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. There's an old classic. The Manchurian Candidate, Deliverance, which hasn't been out in a while, The Searchers, John Wayne, House of Wax, Gaslight, John Hughes' Breakfast Club, I remember that one well, Purple Rain, Dirty Dancing, Roadhouse, Harold and Maude, Being There, Smokey and the Bandit, The Sting, The Apartment, A Tribute to Billy Wilder, Double Indemnity, The Blues Brothers, Raising Arizona, and on, Reanimator, In the Mouth of Madness, Labyrinth, Jim Henson's.
Labyrinth.
Labyrinth.
Labyrinth. Reminds me of A Christmas Carol, which Christmas Story, which was, we just ran last week with Fragile.
Great.
Fragile.
Anyway, that gives you an idea.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, everything from the 30s through the 90s, horror, sci-fi, comedy, comedies, dramas, a little bit of everything. And I'd say easily 95% of the selections are voted on by the fans. We'll do the Facebook polls. Now, of course, I don't want the Facebook polls to become a popularity contest either, because then you push out a lot of the smaller, lesser-known films that people would not otherwise get a chance to see. So what I'll do is I'll put things out on the Facebook polls that I don't necessarily expect a lot of people to vote for them, but I do know that when I do get a couple of votes for them, that they're people who are very appreciative. Just looking at some of our lineup, I mean, films like Jacob's Ladder, which is one of the films get the chance to read, but I mean, Jacob's Ladder is not necessarily a film that got huge numbers on the polls, or even Hal Ashby's Being There, starring Peter Sellers, Harvey with James Stewart from 1950. These are films that on the polls came in the middle or toward the end, but I like to squeeze them in to give that variety so that it's not necessarily a popularity contest, that there are some films, you know, George Cukor's Gaslight from 1944, John Ford's The Searchers with John Wayne. These were not necessarily as popular as things like Dracula and the Muppet Movie on the polls, or Dr. Strangelove or the Blues Brothers, but I do want to include them in the series. Again, I don't want to just show films that you've already seen. The purpose of any film festival or any retrospective is to give you the opportunity to see films on the big screen that you probably might not have seen otherwise.
Good point, yeah.
And it's not necessarily for you to like everything. If you liked everything playing at every film festival, then obviously the film festival has not done its job, in my opinion. The purpose of a film festival is not to like everything. The purpose of a film festival is to see things that you would normally not otherwise like.
Yeah, I can see that.
And so, so I do try really hard to give all of our different series their own unique touch, to make sure that there's something for everyone. It's been very interesting as the years have gone on. The retro Phantasma film series for many years had a reputation, and not undeservedly, for being basically a horror program, a horror film series. And when people would hear the words retro Phantasma, they would think of, you know, the slasher films from the 80s. They would think of the Nightmare on Elm Streets and the Jamie Lee Curtis horror films and the Exorcist and the Friday the 13th. Which was fine. And again, there was that demographic who loved that. And then we started expanding the programming and started showing things, you know, from more family-friendly. And then more recently with comedies and dramas. And what's been very interesting is meeting some of the people who thought that retro was just a horror film series, and they have this image in their heads when they arrive, and you can usually tell that they're being dragged there by, usually it's a grandparent or something that's being dragged there by their grandchild or something like that. And you can see them walking in and just struggling, you know, that they can't believe that they've come to see, you know, this particular film. And then they sit down and they see the intro, which is very, very respectful, and talking of, you know, showing clips of, you know, James Stewart and the old, you know, Universal logos and the Columbia Studios logos. And you see them physically in their seats having this change of attitude of what they thought they were going to experience.
Yeah.
Then the whole trailers start with the "You Are There." If you've never been to a retro program, each show starts with a montage. I'm huge into movie montages. I love them. So I'll spend hours cutting together a good 2 to 3 minute montage of movie clips with music playing and things like that. They've actually become very popular at the series. But we start with montages, which then soon leads into door prizes, which then soon leads into an introduction to the film that's on screen, talking about what was happening in the in the movie industry right before that film was released. So, right. For example, last week we ran A Christmas Story from 1983, and we double billed that with 1968's The Lion in Winter.
Oh, wow.
Starring Peter O'Toole and Catherine Hepburn.
Talk about different cultures.
And we almost sold out.
Fantastic.
I mean, the trick there was bring your family to see a great holiday film, Christmas Story. A very popular entertainment, but then stick around after that for a true holiday classic.
Mm-hmm.
You bring the kids to see A Christmas Story, but then you stay afterwards for a real Christmas classic for the grown-ups and get the kids to stay and watch it with you, and a lot of families did.
And what a classic that particular one is.
Mm-hmm. Especially with Peter O'Toole passing away this last Saturday. It was very poignant. But again, you come to the retro and you see the montages, you see the facts about the movie, and then we actually have movie trailers. So it'll say, and you are there. The following motion pictures are playing on November 8th, 1968, the same day that movie was released.
Yes, that's
to give
a
you that,
clever ploy,
to give
then.
That you are there feeling. And then we literally run trailers that are that if you had gone to see the film on opening night, let's say in 1968, The Lion in Winter, here's a collection of trailers that might possibly have been playing before the film on opening night in 1968.
Perfect.
And so, so we have a lot of families and a lot of people who had a misconception of what retro is are coming. And they come to me in the lobby at intermission. And one of the funniest stories happened recently with Rob Reiner's The Princess Bride. Here's a big classic movie from 1987.
Right.
Mandy Patinkin, a huge cast. And I had this middle-aged woman come up to me about 20 minutes into the show, and I could tell that she had been brought there by her grandchildren. And she came up to the lobby, and she looked around a little lost, and she finally saw me, and she asked me if I worked there, and I explained who I was, that I'm actually the person that picked the movie, and it's my, that's the whole reason you're here is because I programmed it for this festival. And she looked at me with the strangest expression, and she said, "This movie, The Princess Bride, is it the right film that I'm thinking about?" And I said, "Well, I don't know of any other Princess Bride out there." And she says, "Is it supposed to be funny? I didn't know it was supposed to be a comedy. People are laughing."
Oh,
and I looked at her, and I said, "Well, what did you expect it to be?" And she says, "Well, I kind of thought it was going to be more sword and sorcery and blood and guts and lots of body parts flying around." She said, this is a children's movie. And I looked at her and I smiled and I said, "Well, what did you expect it to be? Did you think?" She says, "Well, I'd always heard that you showed horror movies, so I just figured that's what this is going to be." And so, it's been very, very nice
not
to see
exclusively that.
Yeah, it's been very nice to broaden the scope of what we program and to see the audience reaction, especially for some of the audience that has this misconception of what retro phantasma and retro is, and to change that perception on them, and to get them to see films that they might not otherwise have seen on the big screen, that they overlooked for years and years and years, that just never got a chance to see them.
Well, this thing could go on forever.
It probably could.
Sadly, the hour is just about up. We'll pick this up again and continue with another show. But I think this has been a real education to anybody not understanding the term retro film and just things that go on at the Carolina
Theater.
Thank
you for having me as a guest.
It's been an absolute
pleasure.
Always
a pleasure, yes.
And thank you for just letting me sit here and listen. It's been an education.
I do. Yeah, succinct is not a word that's usually mentioned in the same name as me.
Well, Jim Carl, thank you very much for joining us. My friend Bill McClammon, thank you for co-hosting. And Bob, thank you for being so quiet. Wow. This is your host, Claudio of the Speakeasy, signing off. Until next time, cheers.
Is that really an hour? I felt like 10
we
minutes.
Didn't even do another musical.
That felt like 10 minutes.